Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we'll be talking about video game music with our pal, LA Times critic Todd Martins. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Codd. But first, we review some new music from Rina Sawayama and Brian Eno.
That is a little bit of a track called This Hell by Rina Sawayama, her new album, Hold the Girl. Greg, this is a fascinating artist. Born in Niigata in 1990, moved to Northwest London, Japanese English artist. Pop force from day one. When she began recording her first single, 2013, Sleeping in Waking, self-titled debut in 2020. A lot of fans all over the map, genre-wise, of her music that she's collaborated with, from Charlie XCX to Elton John, from Lady Gaga to, you name it. This is an artist who has garnered a lot of attention. This album has been highly anticipated for some time. Let us dive in. Second studio album by Japanese-British singer Rina Sawayama. This is a track called Frankenstein. We'll come back and we will give our opinions of Hold the Girl.
That is Frankenstein from the new Rina Sawayama album, Hold the Girl. I'm glad you chose that track, Jim. I love that track as well.
I love it. That hook, I don't want to be your monster anymore.
You know,
and the videos, I don't often like follow up a single and look at the video, but she's going through, she's this mousy young woman at first, and then the mirror monster jumps out and takes over the club, and it's fun.
She's all over the... I mean, if you like that song, don't hold your breath, because, the other 12 are completely different. I mean, it's 13 songs and jumping from style to style, era to era.
You would literally, if you just pick two songs randomly, not even recognize at first they were from the same album.
Right. She co-wrote all 13 songs. She co-produced all but one of those songs. She's a multifaceted artist. She's very much on top of what's going on here. She's a student of pop history. She name drops all sorts of her heroes, and I, I almost hear this album as like, you know, for lack of a better term, a tribute album to her influences.
Well,
I mean,
and they're not always easy to figure out. We bumped in with a little bit of This Hell, which is, you know, it could be a relationship song. You know, I don't want to be in this hellish situation with you anymore. But also is sort of about our social media era, because she name drops Britney, Lady Di, and Whitney Houston,
right,
all of whom were, you know, beloved and then pilloried by the forces, the fickle forces of popular culture.
Well, there's a lot of social commentary on this record, as opposed to her first record, which is really kind of diving into her childhood. This is more about the, you know, the world outside of that. You know, she's talking about everything from mental health to the health of her community. You know, she's representing women of color. She's, you know, she's identified as bisexual. She's,
yeah, LGBTQ,
you know, she's
plus
talking
rights.
About that community as well. And, you know, jumping, I mean, this record covers a span. There's a, you know, blatant check of Madonna here. You know, Like a Prayer is referenced on that, on one of the tracks on this record, the title track. Up to the Taylor Swift's Evermore record, you know, which came out.
Yeah.
You know, Send My Love to John. I mean, that belongs on that Taylor Swift record.
And I'm sorry for the things I've done. I'm misguided, love to my only son, trying to protect you, but I guess I was wrong. So send my love to John.
So, you know, the full range, I mean, there's, it's almost like it reminds me of some of those Lenny Kravitz records in the 90s.
Yeah.
Where you could, like, spot the influence, like, who's he trying to
and
people, mimic here?
People keep hearing Shania Twain. You know, I wish I loved the entire album as much as I love the singles, This Hell and Frankenstein. But a lot of the record, Greg, triggers two alarms for me. It veers into Disney princess songstress territory at times. And also, you know, Broadway theatricality. And I was like, wow. Those songs, man, I don't want to hear them again.
I guess my biggest problem with it is that as skilled as she is at sort of, you know, name-checking and referencing these musical styles, and she's very good at it. These songs are going to probably sound really good on pop radio. She doesn't
one
have,
at a time.
She doesn't have
an
identity. Who is
right,
she?
Right,
what is her contribution to that history, you know? So that's where I kind of lose this record.
You know, as an album, it's a very uneven listening experience with those peaks, you know, the hit singles being wonderful, and the rest, not so much.
Who gives a thought about the fireflies? Short lives of moving light, perform their quiet flight. Stars of starless nights.
That is a little bit of a song called Who Gives a Thought, which is the lead track on an album called Forever and Ever No More, the 29th solo studio album, Mr. Cott, by one Brian Eno. Okay, I can talk for an hour now about who Brian Eno is, but let me focus not on the production, you know, producing everyone from Talking Heads to you name it, U2, an endless resume, and having a unique philosophy in the recording studio that I think is one of the most inspiring in musical history. Let's talk about Brian Eno, the artist. Four incredibly influential, quote-unquote, pop albums between 1974 and 1977. Those four records were rock records, mm-hmm. but askew in many ways, made by a surrealist fan of Dada. That's where a lot of the influence comes from. Then he stopped singing and went ambient. Music to mingle with the knives and forks at dinner, as Eric Satie, his influence on ambient music, said. There was a notable period in 88, 90, where he sang again. An incredible cover of You Don't Miss Your Water Until the Well Runs Dry that popped up amazingly on Jonathan Demme's soundtrack for Married to the Mob. And then he collaborated with John Cale of the Velvet Underground, a huge influence on Eno, Wrong Way Up. And then he stopped singing again. I interviewed him when Wrong Way Up came out. And I said, Brian, why haven't you sung more? And he's like, I didn't think anybody liked my voice. And it was one of those moments where I don't think he was being, I don't think it was like an interview fake moment. He seemed surprised that I loved his voice. You know, it's not an extraordinary voice, but it's a very English voice, and what he would do with it in the studio when he made quote-unquote pop records was always interesting. Anyway, Eno's been all over social media, and his many fans have been talking about Brian Eno singing again. And indeed, he is on this concept album about, you know, the climate emergency, he calls it. Our planet melting and deteriorating is another way to look at it. Let's play a track, and we will come back and give our thoughts on Brian Eno's Forever and Ever No More. This is called Garden of Stars, and he's telling us these billion years will end. This Earth is dying.
These billion years will end. These billion years will end. These billion years will end. They end in me. They end in me.
That is Garden of Stars from Brian Eno's new album, Forever and Ever No More. Another one of the cheery songs on a very cheery record.
You know, can I preempt you? I mean, the way this works is one of us introduces the album, gives the context, and then the other critic gives the opinion first, and then we go back and forth, right? I'm just going to tell you, I hate this album. I hate this album. I got to get that on the record first, because everybody thinks I'm like the Brian Eno butt kisser of all time.
Well, I don't hate it. I just don't love it. You know, I think everybody's hoping that he'll make another Green World again, especially when he starts singing. But the singing style has changed completely.
And he uses a vocoder. Come on.
And, you know, he talks about feelings. There's this statement as sort of an introduction to the record that he's made. Perhaps it's more accurate to say, I've been feeling about it, you know, his thoughts. And the music grew out of those feelings. You know, I think the point is that in order to change the direction of the world where it's spiraling into its death, you know, it's in its death spiral.
Yeah, hurricanes, droughts.
In order to change that trajectory, we need to change the way we feel about it.
Right.
We're not feeling, and that to me communicates a sense of urgency. Like we've got to love this planet more. Yeah. We've got to do something about it.
But I don't know where the fireflies come in.
What I don't get is the icy remoteness of this record. It is so like arm's length. The singing is. There's a lot of drones in this record. There's no percussion on this record.
No.
It's just atmosphere. His voice is sort of recessed in the background. It's just another texture on the record. It reminds me, you know, he's a big fan of gospel music, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I feel like I am in a church, and I'm at a funeral at that church, and the funeral is for this planet, and it just sort of drones on and on and on, and it's very sad.
It's not a gospel church. It's an English church of
England.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of monks in the medieval monastery.
Very tightly wound preacher lecturing us.
The most visceral moment is in that song you played, Garden of Stars. There's this kind of swell of feedback and static and noise, and I go, yeah, more of that. You know, more of that sort of like, I'm angry or I'm upset. We need to, you know, shake me by the collar and let's say, let's do something here.
You know? In his many interviews, and interviews are as much of an art form for Brian Eno as making records or producing records. You know, he has always characterized those first four albums. I'm talking Here Come the Warm Jets, through Before and After Science, as being fueled by the, quote, idiot energy of rock and roll. Right. And so having matured and having invented many other genres, ambient music and a sort of, Miles Davis like jazz fusion ambient style. Right. He's always been about moving forward. And I don't think he's ever wanted to go back to the idiot energy. But he hasn't been able to fuse, as he did on those albums, in the many since, the rhythmic invention of those records. Because you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, the percussion on those records and the drumming are extraordinary, with the flair for melody and pop songs. He loved doo-wop. He loved rock and roll. He was a big fan of the Velvet Underground. And I think he's lost that ability, you know. And this album is a disappointment because he's got a topic and he is singing. He just leaves out the idiot energy. And what's wrong with that? I know you're hitting 70, whatever, Brian, but, you know, it's fun to be an idiot.
Yeah.
My entire career with this show, yeah.
We open to the blinding sky and let it in, let it in.
That's what we thought about the music from Rina Sawayama and Brian Eno. Now it is your turn. Let us know on our Facebook group or in our Patreon community. Or leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, so we can play it on the show. Coming up, our conversation with video games critic Todd Martins on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island. So we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. And we are back. Today we're talking about something we've never really talked about in depth before. There's always new topics, Greg. Video game music. We've been told by some of our listeners about the rise of video game soundtracks, and we thought it would be a good idea to bring on someone who could teach us a little bit about them, an expert in the field.
We had the chance to talk to the video game critic of the Los Angeles Times, and he's a longtime friend of ours, Todd Martins. We've admired his writing, he's admired our writing, allegedly. But Todd was writing about pop music for a long time before he transitioned into video game stuff. And we're kind of on the same plane with him with the pop music stuff in terms of our understanding of it.
We kind
of
know.
The video game territory was new for us. And Todd really, I think, did a great job of educating us. He chatted with us about how music within games has evolved over the last decade or so.
Neither Greg or I are gamers. I haven't played anything since Tetris, which I love dearly. And, you make the point in schooling us a little bit that there were cool sounds in those early games like Space Invaders, outer space explosions, right? And kind of a Russian repeating folk melody in Tetris and Super Mario Brothers. But essentially music as video games exploded into an art form, I believe they are. Music was a secondary consideration at first because all of the space in the tech of these games was needed for the games.
Absolutely correct. I mean, when you look at the space of video game music, I think, certainly people remember those video game sounds of the 80s and the 90s, and lots of people can hum that Super Mario Brothers theme, you know, even if they only haven't played it in decades, that do, 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 do. Yeah, I mean, so it's a technological evolution too. I mean, so a lot of stuff that was happening was based on what could be, what there was space to store on a cartridge, if you're talking about video game consoles, what there was space, what a sound card could do if you're talking about home computers. So that's why there was, you know, this birth of this sort of movement called chiptune, which was this very digital focused sound. Mm-hmm. Like I said, there was still cool stuff. Like you pointed out the Tetris sort of drawing from Russian folklore. You know, so they still found ways to be experimental and musical within that space. But over the last couple of decades, especially in Western video games, I think music was always a little bit more appreciated in Japan in terms of the video game space. But in Western media, it's really sort of exploded. That I would say it's as comparable or perhaps even like more experimental or more weird than what you see in film and television scores.
Well, you represent a good chunk of our listeners. There's probably a bunch of our listeners that are gamers and are already well-versed in the music that's on there. But you, I think, approach it from a standpoint of where our, a lot of our listeners are at, which is they're kind of looking askance at videos, the video game culture, as, you know, musical. Like, what's good about it? Why should I pay attention to it? And you were in that latter category, right? You were skeptical.
As a fine music critic, as well as a video game critic.
Right.
I think it's important to point out, I mean, I did write about music before I wrote about video games, and I always, you know, even though I was playing games, I wasn't necessarily looking at games. I was kind of looking down on video game music. I saw it as a secondary sort of thing. I remember when I went to college, I met a dorm mate just making small talk, and I was like, what kind of music do you listen to? And, you know, he said, all I really listen to are video game soundtracks. And I was like, floored. I wanted to talk about all sorts of pretentious indie rock. But no, I mean, I was incorrect. There was really a lot of musical stuff happening in that space. And I think in the video game space, you do have a lot of stuff that is a little bit more pop oriented than maybe you'll see more regularly in film or television, where we tend to think of big sort of cinematic scores. You know, I was thinking about this topic to talk to you guys about it, just because, and not to pin, you know, too much on the Grammys or to make the Grammys sound super important. But, you know, the Grammys did add a specific video game music category. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things, you know, like I said, we all have issues with the Grammys, but those kind of things bring attention to like niche genres and niche format. So I thought it was just a good time to sort of maybe highlight what's been going on, you know, the last couple of years.
No, it absolutely is. I mean, we have had several music supervisors on the show over the years, and the space opened up by long-form cable shows, limited edition series, and adventurous television to musicians to reach new audience, whether they were old-time musicians, you know, Handsome Family in True Detective,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Or musicians now crafting music, you know, because the worlds of film, television, and video games are merging.
Mm-hmm.
They really are. And so music is an integral part of that. What was the turning point, Todd, as a lifelong music fan and a music critic, that you said, wow, I've got to pay more attention to these soundtracks?
I think for me, the point where I sort of had that awakening was in 2011. It was a game called Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP. It was a mobile-focused game, kind of this 8-bit looking sort of fantastical game where you're this sort of nameless character. It's kind of obscure, going through this fantastical sort of world, just pointing and clicking. And a Canadian musician by the name of Jim Guthrie, he's played in some indie pop bands, I think Islands and Royal City among them. I'll be honest, Jim Guthrie wasn't somebody I knew by name, but that soundtrack had this mixture of sort of vintage video game feel. Guthrie has spoken in the past about using musical tools on a PlayStation 1 to help craft some of his music with sort of organic guitar effects. But the guitar effects were a little bit mysterious. It was sort of an indie pop soundtrack that had this electro orchestral, but everything was kind of vague and kind of timeless. There was like a sort of mysticism sort of in the air to the music. And I started to pay attention to it because, you know, it wasn't purely electronic. It wasn't purely like a big symphonic score, like a video game trying to mimic, you know, a big blockbuster movie. It was very sort of understated. That was something that was like, I need to pay more attention. I need to know what's going on here.
What is it about, you know, because this music is essentially background music. It's not foregrounded. Like, it's not like, oh, now we're going to stop and we're going to hear this song. Like you might in a Broadway show or, you know, a film which is using a lot of music. Sometimes the images on the screen will be backgrounded to the music because the director wants to highlight that. That doesn't happen at all in video games, right? It's mostly background music.
I think we've started to move away from that a little bit. You know, there were games like around the time of Sword and Sorcery, there was a game called Hohokam, which is essentially a visual album. And the studio tapped electronic artists from an indie label, Ghostly International, to do sort of these chill out sort of vibes for that soundtrack. And, you know, it was very much meant to be listened to, and you were supposed to sort of move in time with the movements. I think some of the thinking started to change where video game music could be more than just background music was, if you look at a game like Myst, which is one of the best-selling PC games of all time, you know, that game didn't originally have a score because the designer, Robin Miller, thought it would distract from the game. So like late in development, he decided to sort of tinker with making a very ambient score. It's very atmospheric, it's very quiet. If you were to listen to it for enjoyment, it'd be something to put on late at night. It would be something to put on as background music if you were reading or cooking. It sort of mimics the feel of the game, and that sort of the music is sort of puzzled together, and it sort of creates this contemplative idea, this contemplative feel where sort of the rhythmic clacks sort of build on one another. So it feels very much like a puzzle piece as a musical composition. And I think that was when composers and maybe even fans, especially in the West, started to think of music as something more than just pure background music that was looped over and over.
I'm going to quote Todd Martins here to Todd Martins. You feel that video game soundtracks are a place where more risks are being taken than in film or television soundtracks. That's a pretty bold statement, too.
You know, that's a bold statement. I think certainly there are places, if you have big blockbuster games like, you know, the Halos of the world and the Destinies of the world, I think those sort of take their cues from blockbuster films like, you know, the Star Wars type films and the John Williams type composers. But I think if you look at, like, especially if you look at what's happening in the independent game space in over the last couple of years, specifically, if you just wanted to focus on like newer stuff, I think you'd see beyond sort of the licensing model of like going and finding big artists, I think you'll see a lot of original pop songs written for video games. I think you'll see a mixture of like weird electronic sounds mixed in with those pop songs. I think the video game audience is like hungry for lots of content. And I think you're seeing a space that is maybe overlooked. It's a younger medium. It doesn't have sort of the institutional knowledge of like film and television. So you're seeing composers who are like, you know, what if we try this? Or what if we create an interactive music video in a song? Or what if we create a song where you're actually choosing the lyrics in the game? And like all those things have started to sort of happen. I wouldn't want to denigrate what's happening in other mediums or other spaces, but I think what's happening in the video game space is a level of interactivity in music that you're not seeing, and that's really mimicking what's going on in the game.
I just wanted to double back for a second, and I'm going to betray my ignorance of gaming, which I do think is an art form. I've had many students in reviewing the arts, my classes, make the eloquent argument, and they seem to always be attracted to the more obscure, abstract, artistic kind of games, right? As opposed to what they called, a term I never knew before, first-person shooter, right? You know, I'm the tank commander, I blow things up, right? So we're talking about, it's no longer, I chop the orc's head off and I hear a certain bit of music every time I do that. There's more of a journey through the dungeons of the castle in search of orcs and maybe getting eaten by one that's ever shifting. Is that what you're saying?
You know, especially those games you pointed out. You know, if you're looking in the independent game space, the first game sort of soundtrack to sort of really get mainstream acclaim was probably Austin Winery's score for Journey. That was recognized for a 2013 Grammy. And that's kind of a very interesting score to me. It does have these sort of ambient electronics. It does have a little bit of orchestral flourishes, but it also has this tinges of like Eastern mysticism that sort of flowed in and flowed out. And this was supposed to be a meditative sort of relaxing game where you just float through these desert landscapes and you sort of occasionally interact with another player who's completely anonymous, and you can only communicate with this other player by visual cues. But the music really sort of referenced that and sort of guided you. The music was sort of an extended hand to sort of look in different areas, prod you to sort of move in different areas. It had this very floaty sort of feel. That was a soundtrack that sort of wasn't designed to be background music, and it wasn't designed to just mimic an action you took. It was designed to sort of prod you into this universe to explore.
When we return, more of our conversation about video game music. Plus, we'll hear messages from you, our listeners. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm-reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. We've been talking with LA Times video game critic Todd Martins about video game soundtracks. Now let's dive into some of his favorites.
Well, you helpfully, Professor Martins, made us a playlist that I've been indulging in for a couple of weeks. The stuff I'm drawn to tends to sound either like Can, krautrock band from the early 70s, or Aphex Twin, god of ambient electronic music. Aphex Twin, Richard D. James, has done some music. He did, an EP remix of Pac-Man?
I'd have to look up the exact year, but he did do an EP remix under a pseudonym, you know, that was just Pac-Man sound.
Well, I guess my question to you is, let's talk about the business before we talk about the art. Why not license a Can track? Can't be that expensive. Who listens to Can besides Jim, Greg, and Todd? God, or an Aphex Twin track. What's in it for the artists who are making this music for games?
It's really interesting because you have, you know, there are composers who have started in the video game space, like Michael Giacchino, who's done, you know, such great work for Pixar, and today does a number of blockbuster films for Marvel and other studios. He started in the video game space doing Medal of Honor. So I think from a business perspective, I think they recognize that the audiences want something that is tailored to the game and tailored to them. It is an opportunity for them to reach out to younger composers, younger artists, perhaps in the electronic space who, you know, don't have a ton of recognition yet. When I mentioned Austin Winery doing that Journey score, I think he was, you know, in his mid-20s when he did that. You know, so these are opportunities for composers who are more, you know, in developing stages of their career. You know, in terms of why spend the money on it, I think game players will turn on you pretty quickly, and it's a very it's a very vocal medium. You know, if you just put something in there that's looped over and over and over and over, the game would very quickly be under a lot of criticism. So I think they're trying to sort of split the ground between having original music.
Yeah. I love what was between the lines there of what Todd was saying. He thought getting out of music criticism, he'd get less guff from readers than video game. And there's no such thing. Like, you're going to be a critic, you're going to take shots on the chin nonstop.
And that's also to say that it's also become an industry, you know. There are video game tours. You know, Final Fantasy was one of the first to do sort of an international tour. And one of their composers, you know, played with the LA Philharmonic at one point. I think these has become big business in terms of touring. Also, it's become a pretty sort of collectible business. You know, video game vinyl goes for a lot of money. There's a company here in Los Angeles called IM8Bit. They specialize in publishing limited edition sort of video game soundtracks on vinyl. I have a couple. So yeah, I think there's an industry of video game composers who have a little bit more freedom. Game players want to feel something that is authentic and is like authored to the game. And, you know, a little industry, the fact that an industry of touring and vinyl sales has sprung out about it certainly doesn't hurt.
It's interesting, too, how this is, it sounds like a potential booming revenue stream for music makers at a time when there aren't revenue streams. Because there's an incredible amount of popularity, these video games. They sell, they're pricey, right? I mean, you're talking about a serious amount of money. My question, though, Todd, is I'm fascinated by the process, the creation of those soundtracks. They've got to be to work so concurrently with what the with what's going on in the game. So, what's the relationship between the creator of the visuals and the guy who's doing the music? I mean, are they one and the same, or are they working together, or does the guy create the visuals and then he says, "Okay, do something with this music-wise"? It's not like you can just make a song up and okay, just stick this in the movie somewhere or stick this in the TV show somewhere. This has got to be integrated, right? It's very much a seamless kind of thing. So how does that work?
If you look at like video game score soundtracks, a lot of the tracks will just be like a minute long or, you know, 90 seconds long. So they're creating a lot of music that, depending on what the game need, you know, games are so complex today, the game engine can just sort of slot in, depending on what direction the character goes or what direction you drive the character, they can just sort of slot in these little tidbits or these little bits and pieces here and there. And then if you look at sort of bigger game soundtracks like The Last of Us Part Two, or if you look at stuff that's happening in the indie game space where the music is more interactive with you, I think the composers there are brought in pretty early. It's not the same as what you see in film and television where you're scoring to a picture. You know, you'll be given animatics, you'll be given concept art, you'll be given scenes to sort of look at from the game, and you'll sort of be sort of charged with trying to come up with a mood and a feel. But a lot of the stuff is brought in pretty early. In the early days, I think they would tack on, you know, story dressings, the music and the writing sort of at the end of the video game process. But that doesn't happen anymore. Composers are brought in pretty early, and the idea is to create enough music, depending on what you as the player do in the game, that there's an audio cue ready to go for it.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. All right, give us two or three songs.
Yeah, we're going to make the Los Angeles Times video game critic go back to his roots as the rock critic who grew up reading us.
Okay, you say the music's so good. Okay, prove it to me. Give me two or three songs.
Yeah, Desert
that are
Island
blow
tracks.
My mind.
Now, this is a lot of pressure because now I don't know if you'll like these songs.
When has that ever mattered?
You're the expert, though. You know that stuff. And listen, you're coming from the same world all of the listeners to the show are, which is you're really into music.
Yeah.
So we trust you, Todd. Give us what you love.
So instead of of going back and looking at the last 40 years of video game music, I did want to focus on stuff that was pretty recent, so people could sort of get a sense of what was happening now and get a sense of, you know, stuff they may start to see crop up now that there is a Grammy category for video game music. So the first thing I wanted to highlight was a song called Follow Unfollow. By the band is credited as OFK. That is from the game We Are OFK. It was released summer of 2022, so it's a pretty recent game. And it's a visual sort of novel, interactive TV show sort of game. Each episode, it's released in 5 parts. Each episode of the game is 45, 50 minutes. So it's essentially a TV show that you play. And it's very light, interactive. Anybody could play it. If you haven't played a video game ever before in your life, you can pick up a controller and you can play We Are OFK. Sorry for the follow. It's a game that deals with sort of 20-somethings in Los Angeles, and the music reflects that. So the music was written by a couple artists in Los Angeles, Thomas Powers and a producer by the name of Luna Shadows. They're best known for working in a Los Angeles band called The Naked and the Famous. Whatever you may think of the band, don't hold that against them here. Think of what they created for this game in conjunction with the game designers, and they worked incredibly closely with Teddy DF. And Teddy is the one of the co-creators of the game. He also sings the song, and they are these very sort of light, very synth-pop, very danceable sort of songs. They have a little bit of electronic. They're trying to sort of extend beyond sort of what we think is sort of digital video game sounds. Follow, Unfollow, I kind of like because lyrics sort of mirror sort of being a 20-something and trying to figure out your job, trying to figure out dating, especially in the social media landscape. It's a very sort of, you know, glittery song. So that was a song I wanted to highlight, and it's a new song, and it's the music was released by a division of Sony, so they got a big major label behind them as well.
Oh, wow.
All right, that's Follow Unfollow by OFK. Todd's given us some of his favorite recent standout music from the video game world. What's your next pick?
Dead of Night. This was from a game called Sayonara Wild Hearts that was released in 2019 by a Swedish studio called Simogo. I hope I pronounced that correctly. But it was my favorite game of 2019. It does fall into a little bit more of the rhythmic category of games, in that you're trying to move to the beats of the music at times. They consider it a visual album, and you play a character who is soaring through this dreamlike metaphorical world to try to sort of make sense of romance and heartbreak. It's a game about personal growth, about coming out of heartbreak and sort of coming out of it stronger at the end. And you just fly through these psychedelic sort of kaleidoscope universes. You know, the song was written by composer Daniel Osen with the writer Jonathan Eng. Jonathan also worked for the game company. So again, you know, this music is done very closely in conjunction with the production of the games. And a Swedish artist, cellist Liania Olsen, I hope I got that right. She was the vocalist. What you hear in the song is a very heavy 80s pop influence with some modern EDM flourishes. A contemporary band. It sounds very similar maybe to a band like Churches, you know, who I'm sure your listeners are familiar with.
A lot of what he said was just ancient Greek to me. I have no idea. But yeah, Churches. Yeah, I know them. Yeah, music. Yeah.
But it's a very fast sound. It's very sleek. It's meant to feel the game. It's meant to match the feel of the game, which is a very fast sort of game where you're flying through these digital worlds. You can hear some video game effects in the background, and you could hear sort of a lot of like repetitive bouncing notes playing with the idea of like a video game score. You hear sort of these nods to like the chiptune era in the background. But I think it's all about sort of bouncing you forward.
Give us one more, Todd. You got a huge playlist, which I think we'll probably be able to share. What would be a third track that you would highlight?
I think if I'm going to have to pick one more and call it a day, I think I would sort of go with a Too Late to Love You. And that's from the game Kentucky Route Zero. That was released over the span of a decade by some Chicago-based artists. Ben Babbitt was the composer. He went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Why I picked this song, you know, there are other songs I really, really love in video game music, but why I picked this song in particular is because it's an example of a song that is interactive in the game. In the presentation of the game, you will pick lyrics of this song, and the song will gently shift its tone based on the lyrics that you pick. And you could sit back and not pick lyrics and just let the background music sort of play. And it's a scene set in a sort of a dive bar sort of game. It shows how in the game space, music can be interactive. It's a very magical realism game dealing with despair, dealing with the post economic crisis of 2008 and sort of trying to humanize the idea of being homeless and what it means to live paycheck to paycheck. But the song is very woozy. It's kind of a electronic take on sort of a languid folksy song. It's a tale of like unrequited love and heartbreak. It has a very light, contemplative, kind of melancholic atmosphere. One thing about the song I should note is the vocals are credited to Junebug. Junebug is not a real person. That is the character in the game. From what I've gathered, the vocals were digitally created. I believe they are Babbitt's voice, just heavily digitally manipulated. The vocals being so processed, it does create kind of this ghostly atmosphere to the track.
You know, what you just said sort of reminded me a little bit of the Gorillaz concept where, you know, especially on the first tour, it was, you know, these kind of cartoons that were essentially supposedly the band. And obviously that wasn't the case, but it was creating this fantasy world that was visual to go with the music.
I think the interactivity too. I mean, Eno for years has been experimenting with releasing tracks, inviting listeners to remix them, and other electronic artists have done that. The video game, until you begin to play it, is a piece of art that's not completed. Mm-hmm. And it seems as if these musicians are the most interesting of them. If I'm asked to choose the lyric, you know, I have to take part in making that music.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the space is attracting, you know, pop artists. And, you know, there was a game last year called Sable that was composed by the group Japanese Breakfast, you know, and that's a beautiful score as well.
Well, now, Todd, I've read your video game reviews in the Los Angeles Times, and you deal with the music as part of the game experience. Is there as yet a dedicated video game music reviewer? Somebody out there who's just doing music from games?
If there is, I have to confess, I haven't found that person. I know there are sites, you know, that dedicate a lot of article space to video game music. I'm sure somewhere on YouTube, media in the video game space is so heavily reliant on digital creators on like YouTube and other sort of social media, on Twitch and platforms like that. I'm sure there is somebody who is an expert on video game music who is doing that I don't know about yet.
Yeah, why bother to write anymore, Greg? You know.
Well, we've been talking to Todd Martins, who writes extensively about music for the Los Angeles Times, particularly in the video game area now. Todd, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lifelong dream and a pleasure to talk.
That wraps up our show on video game music. We might have to revisit this topic in the future again, Greg. But right now, we want to hear from you. What's your favorite piece of new video game music and why? Leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. And speaking of those voice messages, let's hear a couple now.
New messages.
This is Tim checking in from Nashville, Tennessee. Love the show. Love Marissa's book, Her Country. And I think it's very worthwhile to check out the artist Melissa Carper and her album Daddy's Country Gold. Tell me if that isn't one of the best country albums put out in the last couple of decades. It is punk as you know what. Check it out. Melissa Carper, Daddy's Country Gold.
I'm making memories I'd like to remember. I'm meeting new people. Some of their names.
Hi, this is Eric from Newton, Massachusetts, and I'm telling you guys, you just have to listen to White Jesus, Black Problems by Fantastic Negrito. It came out this June. It's got to be one of the best records of the year. The story, the performances, the songs, it's just wonderful. I think you guys would love it, so check it out. Thanks.
Hey, Sound Opinions, it's Tim from Chicago. A buried treasure band I've been loving lately is Teen Mortgage. They're a garage surf punk band out of DC, and they just consistently have been putting out great tracks. Definitely don't get enough attention. Thanks. Love the show.
I don't know if you guys know this, but apparently Paul Westerberg, the frontman of the Replacements, and maybe one of the greatest rock and roll songwriters ever, in my opinion, supposedly has a new album that people have been hearing, you know, under the table style, play it for your friend kind of thing. Maybe you guys, I don't know, should investigate. I sure would love a new Paul Westerberg album.
Hey guys, this is Jimmy No Legs from Detroit. Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, The Mercy Seat, that is my pick for a desert island. It's just amazing, all the stuff that Nick Cave does, but absolutely love that song, and I hope you guys could play that. I'd be honored.
We are prone, rising from our food. All things that are good are
and the seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning.
I just listened to the show about spooky music, and I had to leave a voicemail about the best spooky music album, Dead Man's Bones. It's great, and y'all should feature it on the show. That is all.
Burn the streets, burn the cars, power, power.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Kyle from Big Bend, Wisconsin. I think it would be great if your segment on Sound Opinions could study and review the first five albums from the Scorpions. Now, it's easy to think of Rock You Like a Hurricane and big stadiums and sellouts and lost hair from old age, but if you evaluate the first five albums, they're very bluesy, they're very tubey, and it's a great transition from the hippie rock from the 60s to rock and roll of the 80s. So it's a very interesting view. Many of the songs are very seriously written, very well written, very melodic, and kind of take you down a path. So it would be great if your Sound Opinions team could take a look at the first five albums.
Hey, little dream of a true and wonderful world. And no one will care as long as the world will turn.
Tim Nordstrom here in Billings, Montana. I listened to your show on the sea. And your picks were, well, nothing like you could have done with Sea and Sand from Quadrophenia. The Who have been underrated with this particular album, in my opinion. That song in particular with Daltrey and Townsend's back and forth vocals, with Townsend's staccato stops on his guitar that are so unique to him. And man, just give Quadrophenia another listen out there. It is one of the best albums of all time.
Home.
No more messages.
Thanks again to everyone who left us a message. You can leave yours on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what's on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, real pleasure to catch up with Namdi, who I think is one of the most innovative artists in the art pop realm of the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And do not forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Lots of good stuff. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our Columbia College intern is Lauren Holt, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.
I don't really want to be famous, though. I just called my agent up. They said that my price went up. I said, nah, that's not enough. Know that you can see me always dropping freebies. They still call me greedy, though. We got bills that's adding up. Trying to get my status up.